Thank you, Steve. Hi, everybody. It's Bill, and we hope Wendy. Let me just test it to make sure that the line is going through. Wendy, everything good?
Yes, everything fine here, Bill.
Good.
Thank you.
That's good. For those of you new to the program, Wendy's usually here in studio with me, but she's recuperating from knee surgery, and so she's at home in her home studio, and we're going back and forth. And Wendy, only you will know this. Most listeners won't know this. I'm not usually allowed to go anywhere near the buttons here in the studio, so it's quite a novelty to have me behind the board. Anything
can
happen.
You're doing a great job.
Well, that's very nice of you. But you know what it reminds me of? When I was a kid, my dad and I would watch the original Star Trek, you know, the first Star Trek. And Lieutenant Uhura was behind this panel of all kinds of buttons and lights and knobs and stuff. And I would watch that and I'd say to myself, if I was Lieutenant Uhura, I'd be afraid out of my mind because there's just buttons. And I'd press some and hope for the best. But eventually I'm going to crash into a Klingon ship. And that's how I feel without you here in the studio, is that eventually you and I will crash into a Klingon ship.
No, I think we'll be good.
Yeah? All right. I'm hoping.
You know, and while I'm out, I've got to tell you, I've come up with another entrepreneurial idea.
Oh, like a multi-million dollar idea?
Yes.
What is it?
I have to tell you, you know, when you get your knee replaced, you have some healing that has to happen with the scar. It's big and ugly and Frankenstein-like. Mm. And you have to wear kind of loose-fitting clothing.
Sure.
I don't really have any loose-fitting clothing.
You don't have a muumuu closet at your house? I'm shocked.
I have
a muumuu closet.
No, I have, you know, now you have leggings and you have skinny jeans.
Yeah.
So everything is pretty tight fitting. So I have to borrow sweatpants from the boys and from Jimmy Mack or their pajama bottoms. And I feel like George Costanza. So then I get a little depressed because it's like I'm walking around in sweatpants, big baggy sweatpants all the time.
Sure.
So I'm going to make some surgical wear.
Oh, that's not a bad idea. Now, will this surgical wear... I know this seems like it's Shark Tank, and you're trying to sell me on the idea. Will this surgical wear be specific to people who have only had knee surgeries, or could be any sort of medical surgery?
I would say knee and or hip.
Okay. That area of the body. All right.
Right.
And how will this be different from regular clothing?
Well, it will be loose-fitting.
People will be paying Wendy to wear it.
Oh, I guess that's your answer. All right. Well, then I'm in. I want a part of this.
Stylish fabrics, like maybe some leopard print or something.
Yeah.
Or bear's prints for the guys. Oh, who would wear that?
Stylish is usually universally accepted as leopard print.
Right. Right.
Very popular. But there has to be something. I mean, I really don't have any stylish post-surgical wear.
I don't know there is any. I can't imagine. If you went into a department store and asked for that, they would just stare at you because they don't make that, I don't think. Do they?
No, but I'm going to create that. It all happened on Saturday before Christmas. I made my first journey out to Target to pick up some last-minute video games for the boys.
Mm-hmm.
And Jimmy Mack and I are at Target, and I run into a high school friend of mine. And Glenn Bowie looks at me, and he goes, "Hey, I thought that was your loudmouth." And then he looks down, and I'm wearing, like, not flip-flops, but those, like, Adidas slide-in shoes. They're kind of like sandals meet a slipper.
Oh,
do you know what I'm
talking about?
Oh, okay,
I've seen those. Yeah, I know what those are.
And he looks down at me in my husband's sweatpants and these
Adidas slides. He looked down at you both figuratively and literally.
Absolutely. Bill, he said to me, he goes, "Snyder, what has happened to you? It's a Saturday night at Target.
But didn't
flip-flops
you,
and sweats?
As
really?
You were getting ready, and I know...
Wait, can we examine that sentence?
Yeah, sure.
Snyder, what has happened to you? And it's not about the it's a Saturday night at Target. That's the part that could have been enough.
I guess.
But no, because he was there too, right, so he couldn't judge you based on that, because he was also...
But he was all dressed up looking for a photo album.
Oh, all right. So he won that battle. So,
yeah, because he's like, "Oh, trying to get a photo album together for last-minute Christmas gift." So he won.
All right.
And here
so,
I am in my schlubby clothes.
But as you were getting ready for that little journey, didn't you say to yourself, the potential is there for me to run into somebody who knows me? I should probably just do my best to step it up one or two notches? Or did you just go, "I don't care. I'm on the mend"?
No, I had makeup on. My hair was sort of done. But I don't have post-surgical wear. So we had to wear what I had.
Now, Wendy, I'm with you. My son had some knee surgery yesterday. And so he's got this honking brace on his leg. And so I'm like, what is he going to put on? And his sweatpants are even too tight to get over this thing. So he had to put on a pair of shorts. But that's easy for guys, you know. But for girls, what do we do? And nothing's going to look
schlubby.
Good. Everything baggy is going to look schluppy.
Is this
nothing you can possibly...
I think, Bill, this is a lament to the lost Zuba era,
Right.
I know we need them back.
There was a time where
Zumba pants.
I hope people remember what they are. Is it Zumba or Zumba? It's Zumba,
Zumba.
Right?
Okay, yeah. Zumba. No,
oh, the Zumba pants.
ZBA. Oh. So they were done in prints that were kind of reminiscent of NFL teams, but they also had some animal feel to them, right?
It was psychedelic fanware, kind of. It was like swirly and...
Right.
But it had the colors.
But they were worn by a very specific type of human being.
MC Hammer.
Even MC Hammer go, I don't feel good about that. I'll wear them, but I don't feel good about this. I don't think you could. That was one of those articles of clothing. I don't think as you were wearing, you could feel great about yourself. You just kind of gave in to a Zumba pant, wouldn't you?
Did you wear them?
I never wore them.
Good for you.
I never wore them. You know what I've been going through this week is
members only jacket stash?
Yeah, I still wear those because those will never go out of style. I know that for a fact. I have this really great pair of gloves that are for skiing, but I wear them, you know, just more casually, even if I'm not skiing, because they keep my hands so warm. And like what always happens with gloves is, you know where one is, but you don't know where the other one is. So my wife said, we'll put these on, and she hands me mittens. And I haven't worn mittens since I was six. So all this week, I'm wearing mittens, and I cover them up as people are walking past me on the street, because a grown man really should not be wearing mittens. Gloves are the way to go.
At least you don't have those clips, right, that hold your mittens?
I do not have... I wish I had the clips because I'd use them on my gloves and I'd have two gloves.
So do you get, like, sort of finger sweat?
You don't get finger sweat,
no?
But the things that you're used to doing, you know, as we've evolved as a species, we've realized that there's different needs for each finger, you know?
So
hand gets claustrophobic.
Yes.
I'm picturing you drinking a bottle of water like President Trump in some of those
yes,
pictures.
With two hands.
That's what I'm doing everything.
Hot cocoa.
Right. Right. I can't explain it, but my hands have now been not comfortable for a week and a half because I've been wearing mittens for that long. And I feel like I'm a six-year-old girl in them.
Why a girl?
I don't know why. Because even when I was a little kid and I had to wear them to school, it just didn't feel...
It's a girl word.
Mittens. Mittens. Right. It's too adorable for a guy. Isn't it? Mittens?
You guys are both pretty adorable.
Thank you. Thank you. I wish I could feel better about it, because in theory, they're doing what they're supposed to do. They're keeping my hands warm. But I walk around going, I can't believe I'm a grown guy and I'm wearing mittens. Thank goodness I don't have Zubas, too, because I would just be a mess.
Now you take them off before you hold out your Metro pass, right?
Right.
Okay,
yeah, I don't want the people at Metro to see that. They don't need to see that.
Yeah, I took a ticket from a guy holding mittens.
I've been wearing the sweats, no Zubas, but I have to tell you, I'm kind of throwing down at physical therapy, and I just want to bring this up to you guys, because I don't want to wear long pants there, because I want people to see my battle wound.
Oh,
is
you
that
do?
Bad?
No, why?
Yeah.
But why?
Because when I see, you know, mostly the older people that are rehabbing at physical therapy, and they are mostly older than me, doing way better than I am, they have long pants on, and I, you know, people on a machine next to you, you tend to talk, like, what are you in for?
Right, yeah.
I like to say it loud, say it proud, and show them my hideous scar so they know how much suffering I'm doing.
Oh.
Is that bad?
I don't know if it's bad. Do you feel better, though, when people see it? You go, is this the reason I'm here? You know?
Yeah, because I saw someone in there for plantar fasciitis, which I know really hurts, but then it's like, look at this.
How about this?
Look at this 12-inch long scar.
I see your plantar fasciitis, and I raise you.
a titanium knee.
When I was doing rehab a couple months ago for my calf muscle, it was that kind of conversation. Like if you had a couple minutes and there was somebody working out next to you or rehabbing next to you, there'd be that sort of discussion. And normally, you know, because a tennis injury isn't that glamorous, but the one guy who beat everybody was the guy who fell off a ladder on the third story of his house. He was changing a window pane on the third story of his house and he fell off the ladder. That you can't beat that. Right?
What, did he break both legs?
He broke, he gave me a list. Did you ever have somebody tell you stuff and you don't even know you have that on your body? Like, he was giving me a list of the things he broke, and I'm like, I don't even think I have one of those. No, you have one of those. I don't think I do.
Well, didn't you have a shoulder injury before, too?
Yeah, I did.
Because I was told by the physical therapist that knees...
Which I thought was I thought only women had those, but I have a labrum. I have two labrums. Labri.
Just keep talking.
I should have gone into the medical profession. I don't know why I didn't.
But you're afraid to say you have mittens.
Right. Isn't that slightly peculiar? Just a little? All right, let's do this. We'll take a quick break, and then there's more discussion. Jump in if you like. We're at 312-981-7200. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. It's Bill Leff, and it's Wendy Snyder. Wendy, still not in studio. That'll happen on Monday. She is on the mend from a knee replacement surgery and having a hard time with clothing. Wendy, I think there's somebody who can help you out.
All right.
Susie, can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you.
You went through this, huh?
Great idea with the clothing. A great
See?
Idea because I had a broken arm and a broken wrist in September, and I was in a cast for almost 2 months. I had nothing to wear on top, and you can't put something over your head because you can't get your arm through, and nothing fits, and all I could wear were these huge baggy sweatshirts. And I would have to wear one that zipped and cut the sleeve. I mean, it was ridiculous. You're onto something with clothing. There's no question.
See, now, Susie, I would give you a nice little post-surgical halter top.
Oh, that's nice.
But in the cold weather, it doesn't work. And then you have to wear a coat. I mean, I was wearing
capes. That's true.
I mean, it was the most ridiculous. I didn't even go anywhere because you're right. You feel schleppy. And I remember one time I did something to my Achilles, but it was summer, so I was able to wear a dress or shorts. It's totally different. But in the winter or cold weather and with the baggy clothes, and you're 100% right, you go to rehab. And then where I go to rehab, they're all in their tight spandex, you know, workout clothes.
I mean, where do you go, Lululemon?
No, they're all in Lululemon, though. I'm at Illinois Bone, but they have, like, the section where they have training. People can work out there, so you have two things going on, the physical part, physical therapy, occupational therapy, and then you have the workout room. But everyone's all walking around, and then you're coming in with these monstrous clothes. You look ridiculous. So I go into business with you.
Sounds good, Susie.
Right.
Wendy, you got something. Susie, thanks so much. Have a good New Year.
All right, thanks. You
Take
too.
Care.
Happy New Year.
Bye. More people wanting to help, Wendy. Go ahead. Did you have something to say first?
No, somebody has texted, I'm supposed to go get nurse's scrubs to wear in rehab. They come in many colors and patterns, loose-fitting but not baggy. Bought them for my wife after her third hip replacement. She loved them, and they worked.
That's a good look,
too. Not stretchy enough, though.
Not stretchy enough? No? Nurse's scrubs?
They don't stretch. They're like cotton. And, you know, it's, again, hard putting pants on when you have a knee that doesn't bend all the way.
Can I suggest something? Think about, don't
yes.
say no right away. Think about this for a little bit. Let it ruminate. Spray on clothing.
Oh, I like that.
Spray on clothing.
And then you just shower it off.
Yeah, you'd shower it off. It, like, you know, when you put sun protective stuff on in the summer, it would be like that, but with clothing.
Like sunscreen?
Like you could say sunscreen, yeah.
Or sun protective stuff.
I've been in Times Square where they paint the women.
Oh, they do, yeah.
Right? They paint clothes on.
Yeah, so that's a doable thing. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's a good idea.
What about men?
It wouldn't work for men.
It's a whole shadow thing. It's much harder.
Right. Karen's on the line. Hello, Karen.
Hi. You know, I was just going to say, I'm in physical therapy as well, and I'm in the early 50s. And all the older people than me are the ones that are wearing shorts. So I don't see any problem with it. And why don't you just start, you know, wearing the shorts or whatever works for you? And maybe they'll follow along. Maybe they're too embarrassed to, you know, to show that wound or that scar.
Proud of it, man.
You're the only one, though, Wendy, I know who's just proud of it. Everybody else is trying to hide it. You want it front and center.
I show everybody.
Yeah.
I don't think everybody is trying to hide it because all the people at where I go to physical therapy in Westmont, they're all wearing shorts.
Really?
Everybody.
Huh.
Yes. So
I should go there. I blend in more.
There you go. I go right after work, and sometimes I remember to bring a pair of old sweats or something, and sometimes I forget. So,
Wendy, this could be the new kind of tattoo. Instead of getting your traditional tattoos like people have gotten for centuries, they could be made to look like wounds, like body wounds.
Oh, brother.
Dude, you're not earning that.
No, you have to earn it. You're right. You make a good point. Any of Karen's ideas sounding good to you, though?
Well, I like the shorts, and I'm just going to say it loud, say it proud. Somebody has texted in that I should wear chaps or zipper pants.
Well, you should always wear chaps or zipper pants.
Whatever you can do that helps you bend, you know, bend your knee and stuff. But, yeah, I don't think nurse's scrubs would work.
Sorry, Wendy.
I don't think they give enough.
We tried. Not enough give. Karen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Have a good New Year, which I'm going to say all throughout the year, not just in January. Eric has an idea, but I think Eric's idea is more for me than it is for you, Wendy. What's your idea, Eric?
Bill, Wendy, hello. I have to chime in on your subject of masculinity of mittens.
Yeah, I don't like them. You like them?
Well, it's not that I don't like them. I used to be a firefighter, and back in 1985, we had a weekend where it was literally 80 below with the wind chill, and we were fighting a house fire, and I got frostbite on my fingertips to the point where I got blisters on them. And to this day, it still bothers me, you know, nerve damage.
Oh, no.
So forth, yeah. So the doctors all said, oh, you guys should be wearing mittens. And actually, the fire equipment supply companies offer mittens versus gloves, just because mittens will keep your fingers together and keep your fingers warmer. So in this kind of weather, I really need to wear mittens.
Otherwise. Is that true? Mittens will keep your hands warmer than gloves? I'm shocked.
Yeah, they're all huddled together, keeping warm with each other.
Yeah, and you know who says that is your own WGN's Dr. Most.
Well, if Dr. Most says it, it must be true. All right.
Is. Yeah, it keeps your fingers together, and the heat from each adjacent digit, you know, keeps the other fingers warm.
But what about mobility? You know how you're used to each finger has its own personality. You know that. I don't have to tell you that, Eric. But you can't do the things you want to do. Each finger is forced to do whatever the hand wants. I think each finger should have their own voice.
Yeah, there's a, you lose a little bit of mobility,
yeah,
I suppose, but you still have, you know, a free thumb. But,
you flip somebody off with a mitten, it has no impact whatsoever. They don't even flinch.
Exactly.
Eric, thank you so much. I'm sorry to hear about your fingers. That's awful. They're still hurting you all these years later?
Yeah, it's a hazard of the job.
Oh.
I mean, I've had 5 rotator cuff surgeries and, you know, various injuries over the years, so just comes with the job.
Wow.
Take it.
All right, take care of yourself. Be careful. All right.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
How about that, Wendy? I thought you led the league, but Eric's blowing you out of the water. Let me get one more in really quick. Elizabeth, how are you?
Hey, I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. What's up?
Well, I got to tell you, I went to college in the UP, and I live in southwestern Michigan, and I thought, we have snow, I'll be fine. I had my little fashionable cloth coat and my little gloves. I came home at Thanksgiving break and told my mom, I'm going to die. I got to get a real coat. And I got a coat that made me look like a linebacker for the Bears, but I was warm, and I didn't get frostbite, and I wear mittens because I don't like being cold. And when it's below zero, it doesn't matter how you look. You need to be warm and safe. And Eric is absolutely right. Mittens keep your hands warmer than gloves.
Mittens the way to go. I'm shocked to hear this. All right.
And they look cute on you, Bill.
Do you think so, really? I have the Hello Kitty ones.
Stocking kit?
Yeah, I like them. Thank you for the advice, Elizabeth. Have a good New Year.
You too.
Take care. Bye. All right. Let's do this. We'll take a break. We'll get some news in. And then our friend Rich Lankoff comes by. Wendy, do you remember months and months ago, Rich told us about a project he was working on, a documentary about the Bears? Thanks, Steve. You all know Rich Lankoff, a frequent contributor to the show. He's our legal counsel here on the Bill and Wendy Show. He has his own podcast.
We need it.
Well, boy, do we need it. He's on our speed dial. He's a podcaster. He has a show called Legal Face Off on WGN Plus. He's an attorney over at Bryce Downey and Lakoff. And like I said, he joins us right now to talk about a documentary he has produced called 85, The Greatest Team in Football History. How are you, Rich? Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Bill. Happy New Year, Wendy. Glad to be on.
Oh, go on, Wendy.
No, I was just going to say, now, the Bears we laugh at right now, and we're not very happy with them. But back in 1985, really, the greatest team of all time.
In our opinion, no question. We've had a lot of feedback, a lot of pushback from some people on our very bold title of the greatest, not just, you know, NFL team, but greatest football team of all time. But, yeah, I think, you know, given the state of the Bears now, which is tough, and given the fact that they had one loss, and you know, we all know the defense, the offense. So yeah, we feel very strongly that our claim of the greatest team of all time is well-founded, well-supported.
So when people will argue this point, Rich, they will say that the Miami Dolphins had a year where they were undefeated. The Patriots had a couple of unbelievable years. The Steelers did. The Cowboys had a couple of years that were just amazing. Why do you think this Bears team will be the one that history looks at as the best of all time?
Super Bowl shuffle.
Well, is that why? Is it the Super Bowl shuffle?
Yeah, the best video of all time. That says it all. You know, my answer, I mean, there's a lot of answers, but one of my answers is simple. I mean, name four players from any of those teams, right?
Yeah.
I mean, unless you're a diehard Dolphins fan, unless you're a diehard Patriots fan,
Larry Zonka, Mercury Morris, Jim Kick, Bob Greasy.
Look at you. Keep going, Wendy. I bet you could do more.
That might be all.
Paul Warfield, Nick Bonaconte, Gary Uprimian. Yeah, all right. Go on, Rich.
Dated him.
Yeah, as I said, name 10 players from that team. You know, I think that not only on the field, I think unquestionably on the field, you know, this team holds up. They had one loss. Dolphins were undefeated. So there's certainly that dynamic. There's certainly that argument. The Patriots team, you know, had the one loss as well in the Super Bowl. But I think more than that, and what our film, I think, really encompasses, more than some past looks at this team is the impact they had culturally, the impact they had politically, the impact they had not just on the field but off the field, on the city, on
a bunch of personalities, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, personalities. Why I said, you know, it's hard to name any players from those other teams is because, you know, these guys are still relevant today. I mean, how many teams in any sport in history can you name, like, 20 players from, are still around, are still beloved, not just in Chicago, but across, you know, across the world. So I think the impact of that team, you know, as reflected by people like Barack Obama, who we interviewed, Bill Murray, lots of others, is the impact they had, you know, not just between the lines, but you know, across a broad spectrum of areas.
Rich, despite the success, you can't even argue the success of that team, the 85 Bears, there was quite a bit of animosity.
No question, and that also makes the story, you know, that much more relevant and interesting and impactful, you know, which we cover. And again, I think, you know, a lot of people look at the film as, hey, we've heard the story. Believe me, you know, you haven't heard all of the stories. You think you've heard all of the things that went on between the offense and defense and between the coaches, but you haven't heard half of it. Our film really goes into stuff you haven't heard. Yeah, the offense-defense conflict has been well-documented, and it was real. I mean, you know, they genuinely didn't like each other, and part of that was the fact that there was not a lot of competition with other teams, so the competition really existed, you know, in the locker room and in practice, and we cover a lot of that. You know, because they were so dominant, they really had to, you know, go at it against each other to be fulfilled from a competitive level.
I didn't know that. Common knowledge that there was so much animosity between players? I know coaches and owners and such.
You got to watch the film to find that out.
Ah, look at you. What a pro.
Tease.
Yeah,
what
but,
a
no,
pro.
There was, I mean, listen, at the end of the day, the players, I think they're all brothers, right? And more than ever, after 30, 35 years, they still have incredibly strong relationships. But as our film discusses, I mean, yeah, there was a lot of hostility. There was a lot of conflict. You know, the offense didn't get a lot of attention. You know, even though they had great stats, they had amazing players. A lot of the animosity resulted from all of the coverage that the defense got. So, yeah, I mean, there was some real conflict there. And, again, a lot of it was just the fact that these guys weren't being fulfilled on the field, and in practice is where they really went at it.
Rich, you tell me, because I've grown up believing that Mike Ditka and Buddy Ryan respected each other but didn't like each other. Was that kind of true or not true?
Yep, that's true. I mean, we cover that. We had Coach Ditka interviewed extensively in the film. You know, of course, we couldn't have Coach Ryan on because he passed away, unfortunately. But, yeah, we cover that story extensively. We go into some detail that you haven't heard before. You know, everyone has heard about a couple of the, you know, almost fist fights that they got into. But, yeah, I mean, there's some real animosity there. And we also go into the story of, you know, what happened when Ryan was leaving, when he went to take the Eagles job, and how that played a big part in why the Bears weren't successful after 85 in terms of winning another Super Bowl.
Well, let's talk about that, because usually if you have a team that's that dominant, and they were incredibly dominant, there's going to be some carryover. It's going to be called a dynasty at some point. You're going to win 2, 3, 4 championships. The Bears, one and done. That's kind of the saddest part of the story, isn't it?
It's, you know, the yin and yang of that team is how dominant they were, how incredible they were, how much they touched the city and the whole world, and yet they could have replicated for a number of reasons. They couldn't get back to the Super Bowl, even though they had arguably, you know, better team, you know, in the next couple of years through a series of events that we cover in the film, through our interviews, you know, things like, you know, Buddy Ryan, of course, was a big factor in his leaving. Him leaving was a big factor. Several players in our film commented on the fact that they thought that Ditka, you know, got a little bit too maybe big for the team. You know, in 85, he was still sort of a raw coach. Afterwards, with all the publicity, several of the players commented on the fact that they thought that was the reason they couldn't go back, because of the attention that he was getting. Of course, they had injuries. So, yeah, there's a number of reasons that coalesced to make that team one and done.
You mentioned interviews. Now, who will be featured in this documentary from the Bears?
So we've got about 30 different people interviewed in our film, about 15 or 16 of the Bears. So everyone from Jim McMahon, Dan Hampton, Otis Wilson, who's one of our producers, Willie Gault, Matt Sui. So, you know, most of your favorites from the team are interviewed. Then we've also got, you know, interviews with prominent Bears fans. Everyone from, I mentioned Barack Obama, who is incredibly gracious. Incredibly touching things he told us about his feelings. We have Rahm Emanuel, Bill Murray, George Wendt, Jeremy Piven, Joe Mantegna. We've got Ike Barinholtz, Rick Callender, so Mike Wilbon. Just an amazing, we think, cross-section of people who still today, you know, are huge fans of that team.
Is this the first time you've ever produced a film or a documentary, Rich?
You know, so on the legal side, I've been involved in entertainment law for a while, and I've represented, you know, several entities. This is the second time I've been involved in a film. I also produced a film, or helped produce a film about the Montreal Expos, which is, as you know, a team near and dear to my heart growing up in Montreal. Yeah, this was the first one that I was the lead producer on, myself and my producing partner Scott Preston, who's also our director, were the leads. So yeah, it was the first one of this scale that we jumped into.
What are you proudest, most proud about? I mean, it's a huge undertaking to produce a film or a documentary. When you sit back now that it's completed, what are you most proud of?
You know, I think the fact that we documented a lot of the stories that have been told. You know, when I got started with Otis Wilson, who's you know, legendary member of that team, also one of our producers, a few years ago, what he told me is that even though there's been a couple of different takes on that team, in his mind, in his eyes, from the player's perspective, you know, they haven't really had a chance to tell their story. As hard as that might seem to some people to believe, you know, there's a lot of people who say, do we need another story? The players felt like they really wanted to memorialize for the final time their story. And honestly, as we know, a lot of the players aren't around anymore, unfortunately. You know, Dave Duerson, Walter Payton. So I think we really capture some touching parts of that team that have been told and that also are now going to be memorialized for all time. That's one thing. And then, you know, obviously getting people like Bill Murray was a huge thrill. Getting the president, you know, we're really proud that we were able to attract such a huge and diverse range of talent.
I bet it's harder getting Bill Murray than it is getting the former president, isn't it? It is, isn't it?
It's funny that you say that, because, you know, we've talked about, you know, doing sort of a short on getting Bill Murray, because it literally was harder to get him than the leader of the free world. Bill Murray, as you probably know, is legendary for his lack of accessibility. You know, he doesn't have a publicist, doesn't have an agent, doesn't have a manager.
You have to leave a message on his machine, right?
Yep, exactly. Like, I heard those stories forever. Like, you know, I thought it wasn't true, but you literally have to call an answering machine. He may call you back. You know, we literally had about 16 hours notice. He called my director, Scott Preston, texted him and said, I'll be at LAX. I'll be at the Delta Lounge in, like, you know, 7 hours. We have to scramble, get a crew over there. We got him. It was a great interview. He's incredibly gracious, incredibly supportive. But, yeah, it was not easy getting Bill Murray, but what he gave us in the film was incredible stuff.
The film is called 85, The Greatest Team in Football History. It's premiering at the Pro Football Hall of Fame in Canton, Ohio. But how can us regular folks see it, Rich? What do we need to do?
Yeah, everyone could see it. Fathom Events is sponsoring the release of the film on January 29th. It's available in theaters everywhere. It's playing probably in about 30 theaters around Chicago, suburbs, northwest Indiana, and then across the country. It's playing 260 theaters, I think, in Alaska and across the country. So it's available right now at Fathom Events, their website. It's on Fandango. Anywhere you buy movie tickets, you could purchase tickets for the screening on January 29th.
Do you have to have seen the other Star Wars films to enjoy this one?
Yeah, this one stands alone.
Stands alone. Good.
Yeah, I think.
Congrats.
The backstory. Yeah.
I love it. All right, Rich Lankoff is our guest. Again, the film is called 85, the greatest team in football history. We'll continue this discussion in just a moment. Stick around. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. It's Bill F. and it's Wendy Snyder, along with our guest Rich Lankoff. Normally when Rich is on, we talk about legal issues. He's the host of the WGN Plus podcast Legal Face-Off, but today he's here in the role of a film producer. He has put together a documentary called 85, The Greatest Team in Football History, which features many of your favorite Chicago Bears, in addition to Bill Murray and Barack Obama and Mayor Emanuel and other people. Would you say, Rich, now I know the team had a lot of heroes, but if you could pick one guy to be the unsung hero of that team, the 85 Bears, the guy that doesn't get the attention he deserves but really played a major role in the team, who would it be?
Wow, you're putting me on the spot with that one. I think one of the candidates is Dennis McKinnon, who's in our film. You know, McKinnon didn't get as much attention as Willie Gault,
yeah,
you know, on the outside, but McKinnon, I think, was a huge contributor to that team. Very underrated part of the offense. I think the offense in general, as I mentioned, was, you know, didn't get as much attention as they should have. But yeah, I think McKinnon is right up there.
Dennis McKinnon.
By the way, if you're interested, as a late guest, I've got our narrator, Matt Walsh, who's a huge fan of your show, standing with me here. Matt Walsh is from Veep. Everyone loves Veep. He's a native.
I was just going to bring him up.
Matt, how are you?
He's right here. He's grabbing an egg sandwich here in the lobby of our hotel.
That's what the stars do, Rich. They eat the egg sandwiches.
You know, they're just like us.
Yes, they are.
If you're interested, let me see if I could grab. If you're interested, I could grab Matt Walsh.
No.
In between bites.
No, forget it.
No. Yeah, put him on. I used to do stand up with Matt.
He said he knew you. All right, I'm gonna put him on here for an impromptu interview. Hang on 1 second. Let me give you Matt Walsh.
All right.
Hello?
Matt, how are you?
Hey, Matt.
Bill, how are you? Hi, Wendy.
So great to talk to you. It's Matt Walsh, everybody, from Veep and from a thousand other projects. And he is he's running the panel tonight of the documentary 85, The Greatest Team in Football History. First of all, Matt, congrats on all your success. I couldn't be more proud of you.
Oh, that's very sweet. Thank you.
Love seeing you in everything you do. Second of all, what did this team mean to you? You were growing up in Chicago at the time. What did the 85 Bears mean to you?
I just had I was in college at Northern Illinois, and I just remember the joy of reading every paper after, you know, every Monday was just filled with great stories about how great this team was. So it was like, it was almost like living in the aftermath every week. And then I just remember being in DeKalb, and it was snowing, and we won, and it was just like an excuse to drink more. It was wonderful.
Oh, that was such an exciting night.
Yeah, it was.
With the snow.
And it was just elevated the way that Chicago got all this attention. Like, it just really brought out a lot of pride in the city and unified, like, everyone's interest. It was completely consuming. I think everyone in Illinois was on the bandwagon. It was really fun to see that kind of pride and celebration, you know, all the time. It was amazing.
Matt, do you remember after the Super Bowl win, and the Bears not only won, but they just dominated the game from the first minute to the last minute. They were so strong. But the controversy afterwards was, why didn't the team let Walter Payton score a touchdown? Do you remember that?
I do, and I've, like, gone into some of the articles around that sort of controversy, and I think the truth is like they were keying on him. They had at least two guys shadowing him every play, and I think the Patriots decided that you're not going to beat us with Walter. And I think Dick even says in the documentary that these guys made is that that's his one regret. He didn't realize that it mattered as much to him or whatever. So it's unfortunate. And I guess putting the fridge in for a touchdown. But, I mean, I don't know. I guess it's the reason that it gives us something to talk about, whatever, 30
sure.
years.
Sure. And, if you'll remember, in the fourth quarter, even Ditka scored a touchdown. Remember, he put himself in, and he scored a touchdown at the end?
I remember the Honey Bears scoring.
They each scored a touchdown.
I don't remember Ditka.
Right.
They
brought Abe Gibron back. Abe Gibron scored a touchdown. It was nuts.
I think it did because mustache got an extra point.
Yes, it did. Yes, it did.
Yeah.
Matt, I want to know if it was difficult working with Steve McMichael's little purse dog during this.
I didn't get to meet the purse dog, but he's a good wild card. He's very unpredictable. Have you guys run into him lately?
Yeah. Wendy goes clubbing with him.
Yeah.
Yep.
The dog or Steve?
Yeah, with the dog. It's crazy.
Yeah.
They travel in the same circles. And then, Matt, I have to ask you something kind of on the personal side. Veep is one of the best shows on TV, and boy, you've done such a great job. Everybody in the cast is just so strong. I know Julia has had a very difficult year. How are things going there? Is she doing okay?
Good, yeah. Her prognosis remains excellent. She's got the best doctor. She has a tremendous amount of loving family around her, so everything seems to be going well.
That's such good news.
I love
news.
It on her Twitter feed where she's flipping off 2017. It's really funny and really great.
Yeah, she's a strong, she's a very strong person.
That's
so
such good news.
Knock on wood, I think everything's going well.
And what do you work at beyond Veep? What do you have coming down the pike? Are you have any projects coming that you like to talk about?
What am I up to? I did this documentary on the 85 Bears. Mm-hmm. I'm in a Melissa McCarthy movie called Life of the Party that comes out in the spring. I'm going to Sundance with a movie called Futile and Stupid Gesture, which is about the rise of the National Lampoon Comedy Magazine.
Oh, nice.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really fun. And I'm trying to think what else. I guess those are like the things that come to mind. I don't know.
That's quite a bit.
Suffering through three children right now. Very hectic at home.
Three. Wow.
10, 8, and 6, and the 10-year-old is acting like he's 18, which is a little early.
It's a little early for that. Yeah.
Wait
yeah,
till
yeah.
he's 18.
Yeah, a little early for that.
Are they impressed by the fact that they are they loving the fact that they can see their dad on TV or on the big screen almost any day of the year?
I think in shows that they're more impressed. Like I think they saw him. I did something in Yo Gabba Gabba, and if I'm on a sitcom, they can watch. But they've never seen Veep yet. Maybe the 10-year-old's ready for that kind of language. But generally, I do a lot of R-rated stuff, so they haven't really seen. But they saw Ghostbusters. They were really. My son Emmett was like, we went to see it, and there was only like 5 people in the theater when we went to see it, and my son Emmett introduced himself to strangers and said, my dad's in this movie. You know? So
that's adorable. Funny.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, it was very sweet.
It was so great talking to you. And please, next time you're in Chicago, absolutely stop by. We'd love to see you, Matt, okay?
I would love to. Yeah, I love hanging out with you guys.
I hope so.
Thanks, Matt.
Are you in the new building?
Not yet. Very soon. And actually, we're going to call you because we're going to need some help moving stuff over.
Yeah, and you got to carve something for the new tenants to find. Like, put something vulgar underneath the table.
Already done. That's already been done. Thank you. Have a great New Year, Matt. We appreciate you being here.
You too. Happy New Year, guys.
That's Matt Walsh. Thanks, from Veep. He is in charge of the panel tonight at the Pro Football Hall of Fame in Canton, Ohio. It's the premiere of 85, the greatest team in football history, produced by our friend Rich Linkoff. Rich, are you there still?
I'm still here.
Congrats on getting this project done. I know how hard you've been working on it. I'm so glad to see it finally completed and anxious to see it. And everyone can see it on January 29th. That's when it's available in theaters. Good luck tonight, Rich.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for all your support. You guys have been awesome. And we'll see you back shortly for our regular legal segment.
Can't wait. It's Rich Lankoff, everybody.
We'll need it. Thanks, Rich.
We will definitely need it. A quick break and then more show. Stick around. Bill and Wendy, WGN. That's John Duffy on the piano.
Wow, he's good.
Is it? John, honestly, I don't know why you don't do Madison Square Garden.
It really is just a hobby, guys. You know,
but the passion shows. I mean, you can hear the passion in your playing.
Well, I just want, I wanted to create some background for you.
It's beautiful music. It's beautiful. Steve's News, by the way, sponsored by Victory Auto Wreckers and by Grandview Homes. Grandview Homes wanted to wait and see how the newscast went before they announced their sponsorship, and they were happy with it. So congratulations on that, Steve.
You know, John Duffy could have just walked over across yards and come to my home studio here today.
It would have been easier.
I hadn't thought of this, Wendy, but this is that would have been a great idea. I'm not a very good problem solver in that way.
Can I let you in on a secret, John, that nobody knows until now? The Tribune is moving. WGN is moving, and we're moving to Wendy's house. That's the location we all chose.
That's ideal.
It's going to be so easy.
That's going to work out for us.
I know. New Year to you.
Happy New Year.
Now, one of the things we want to discuss today is this. New Year's resolutions have become an almost must for many people. As the New Year approaches, they go, I got to do something to better myself. I'm going to make a resolution. I'm going to stick with it all year and be a better person.
Yeah.
But you say that's not such a good idea, is it?
Well, first of all, I read this statistic the other day that resonates. By February 1st, 8% of people keep their resolution.
8%.
8%. And so you think about what goes wrong. And here's the trajectory as far as I can tell. We start in December, and we start with the parties, and we start with all the, you know, holiday stuff. And it's emotional, and it's stressful, and it's draining, and it's great, mm-hmm. and it's fun. Mm-hmm. And then immediately in the wake of that, on January 1st, you know, when most of us are hungover and struggling, we expect, I'm going to create a whole new me starting today.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm already seeing people at work who are disappointed in the way their year has gone. And this is typically a time of year when it's cold and it's dark and we're kind of on the back end of holidays. We've still got some family around and we really just want to hang out
right.
and relax. And I think we need to give ourselves permission for a little while to do that. So the resolution itself, this idea of starting right away, I don't think it really works with our chemistry very well.
It's a lot of pressure. You're putting a lot of pressure on yourself.
Way too much pressure. Yeah. Undue pressure.
And then you feel so bad when you do break that resolution. If it's day one, if it's day 20, you say to yourself, wow, I really thought I could stick to this, and I'm not strong enough to stick to it.
Yes, and it has that kind of falling off the wagon feel to it. Like, you know, it didn't work out. Maybe next year.
Yeah.
Instead of like, I'll try again in a couple of weeks when I feel more like I'm on my game.
Right.
Yeah.
That makes a lot more sense.
And you can better yourself. It doesn't have to be January 1st. I quit smoking on November 12th. No day. It's just all of a sudden I'm like, I'm going to quit smoking before knee surgery. And now that's one resolution I don't have to worry about on January 1st.
Brilliant.
That's so
good.
Can't
you just do it any time of the year just to try and better yourself? And I guess that my question to you is, everybody wants all or nothing. Like, I'm going to lose weight. I'm going to quit smoking. I'm going to eat better. You really have to take it in small steps or you really are going to fail.
You do. It has to be incremental because if you and some people are so vague. I want to be better. I want to lose weight. And that's so vague that by January 10th, that doesn't mean a whole lot. If you're really clear, you have these measurable, achievable steps and you say by January 30th, I want to get to the gym 8 times.
Yeah.
If you've never been before.
Yeah.
And you can say, OK, I did that. That's successful. Now in February, I'm going to do a 10 and in March, I'm going to do a 12. Then you've got a shot. If you say, I'm going to lose weight this year, or I'm going to get in shape this year, it's really hard to really measure that and hold yourself accountable to that because it's so vague and life takes over, right? Because whatever stopped us last year is probably going to stop us again this year.
Right.
Yeah.
Is the key to that, John, I noticed you increased your increments. Like you said, I'm going to work out 8 times this month and 10 times next and the 12. Is that part of the key to it?
Listen, I always, when I'm working with somebody, I always want to build in wins. So even if it's like small increments, if it was 3 or 4 times in this,
right.
if you've never been before. I worked with a guy who hadn't been running in 20 years, and he started walking around the block once, and then twice the next night, and then three times the next night, and the guy ran a half marathon after about a year. So if you work in these little increments, eventually they become big deals, and you feel like every day or every week is a win instead of like, ah, I blew it. I just couldn't do it this time.
You know what I see every year in January? The health clubs or the gyms are filled to the rafters with people who have made a New Year's resolution. This is the year I'm going to take care of myself a little bit better. I'm going to work out more. And I always see people that are very awkward and don't know what the machines do, and they just kind of walk around and look around. And I give those people so much credit, because when you're in a room filled with people that are there normally and know what they're doing and are in really good shape, it's so hard to fit into that environment.
It's intimidating.
Intimidating. Yeah, I think it's really, really difficult to get yourself in that space. And I give people a lot of credit, too, who are willing to make that move. Yeah. What I usually tell people, though, is that most any gym – I interviewed a guy recently who owns a gym here in the city, and he said, what we – focus on is not what you look like, but that you're here. The fact that you're here is the win. And so everyone's here to support you, you know? And nobody's paying that much attention to whether you're overweight or whether you're clumsy on the machines and you don't know how to work them.
Right.
Most people are just proud of you for being here.
Right.
You know?
Right. Is there anybody that you would suggest that they should make a New Year's resolution? You've already said it's not a good idea, but is there anybody out there that you say to yourself, but this is kind of a jumpstart for this person, maybe they should?
Yeah. I think I don't mind that arbitrary idea of, hey, new year, new me kind of thing. The problem that most people have is they start off running so hard, right? I have to start on January 1st instead of saying sometime in January, I want to get going. And what people focus on is what they want to achieve instead of how they want to feel. And this may seem like psychobabble, but if you say, like, I want to feel strong, I want to feel healthy, I want to feel lean in the new year, if you if you put words like that to it instead of like, I want to lose X number of pounds, then I think you can kind of dig into that and work toward that feeling, and you'll feel more success than you will if you have this kind of arbitrary number that you want to achieve.
What is it about the psychology for us of saying to ourselves, it should start on January 1st, and not even January 1st? I know a lot of people will start their diets, or if there's something you're trying to change about yourself, it's the first of the month, or it's on a birthday or something.
Or a Monday.
Right.
We like those kind of benchmarks, right? We like something that we can measure by. And January 1st, as arbitrary as it is, feels to us like a new beginning, right?
Yeah,
so,
I guess
our birthdays sometimes feel like a new beginning, January 1st, certain anniversaries, and we want to work from that and be able to measure progress over the course of a year. I don't mind that a whole lot, you know, but as long as it's not, I expect too much of myself right away. Again, it's arbitrary. So, Wendy, to your point, I don't mind the idea of saying I'm starting Tuesday, and, and hopefully by, you know, a month from now, I'll feel better and I'm going to work toward that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think if you set goals for yourself that are realistic, for instance, my resolution this year, I'm not going
to
eat cauliflower.
Nicer to people.
No.
What? You're not eating cauliflower?
I'm not going to have any cauliflower in 2018. Now, that's an easy one for me because I can't stand cauliflower and I don't eat it regularly.
And you achieved it in 2017, actually.
I did it. This will be the 38th year in a row, actually. I've been able to pull this off. So, yeah. All right, let's do this. We'll take a quick break, and then there's more with Dr. John Duffy. If you have any questions or comments, we would love to hear from you. He's very, very helpful. 312-981-7200. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. Dr. John Duffy is in studio with Wendy and myself. He is a clinical psychologist, best-selling author of The Available Parent. He's a life coach. DrJohnDuffy.com is his website. So along with John talking about New Year's resolutions, we should also address the fact that a lot of people, as exciting as the holidays are, there's sort of a dip afterwards. I guess it's a post-holiday depression is what it's referred to as.
Yeah, right? Why does that happen?
Yeah, you know, I think it happens because some of us just, we get so, it's almost like that moment after a wedding. We get so fired up for the moment, right? And we decorate and we get excited and we have all this anticipation. And then in a heartbeat, it's just over. And I think when we're confronted with things like that, it's hard not to slip into a depression, especially when there's nothing kind of filling the gap. So a lot of us are kind of like just back to our old routines and nothing feels like it's changed. And I think we feel like, oh, something big is going to happen because the holidays are awesome. And if nothing big happens, then we feel like let down and depressed. And that's coupled with the time of year, you know, where we tend to be a little more sedentary and a little hanging out, a little less social, hanging out at home a little bit more, watching Walsh on Veep a little more than we would
maybe,
otherwise.
Possibly.
And
yeah.
12 days of back-to-back freezing, frigid temperatures doesn't help either.
This year's probably going to be tougher for a lot of people. And I've already run into a little bit of it in my office in just a couple of days I've been back. That a lot of people are suffering from it. And the key part of the resolution of that is to do something to get out and about, even in this ice cold
sure.
temperatures, you know, to head out and shop or to go to the gym once in a while, not necessarily to meet a resolution, but just to enjoy yourself a little bit.
Yeah.
And, you know, because we tend to do a lot of things that we don't enjoy in the wake of 3 weeks that we love.
Right. Is somebody,
can I ask you a question?
Oh, go on. Yeah, Wendy.
You know, when you're, again, social media is bad for all of us, I believe, because when you're looking at other people's family vacations, Christmas vacations, a lot of people celebrate the holidays in warm places, and you're looking at their photos and you're like, that is a well-grounded, awesome family. What's my family's problem? Do you feel yeah. there's a lot of comparison going on? Because I've been doing that a little bit, I got to admit.
Like you wouldn't believe, Wendy. The social media is insidious, and we are forever comparing our story to everybody else's story, and we tend to look up. I mean, I don't know what this is about our culture, but we tend to compare ourselves to people we think are having a better time or doing better in their lives than we are. And yeah, that is kind of a fundamental component of depression, feeling like, everyone's kind of beating me here and I'm not really enjoying myself the way I should. And that judgment alone, that self-judgment, takes us out of the game.
Is there a way to fix yep. that? Is
well,
it just the realization that you can't? Yeah, I
honestly,
think that's part of it, right?
That's a big part of it, right? I totally agree. If you can avoid going on Facebook, I'm working with a few adults who are taking social media off their phones for a couple of months
mm-hmm.
this time of year, in
mm-hmm.
part because of what you're saying, Wendy, that, you know, like, yeah, this time of year, it's too hard to compare myself with somebody who's in Hawaii right now, you know,
right.
like and having the time of their lives.
Yeah.
So I think that's actually a really sound idea is to or spend less time at the very least staring at other people's stories. And the fact that you stare at Facebook for any period of time is agitating unto itself, you know, like just for the brain.
Right.
Yeah.
How do we get Donald Trump off of Twitter? Because we need to do
there
that.
Way?
There's something called
big button.
There's something called the Goldwater Law or something that prevents me from answering that
oh,
one.
All right. That's fine. That's all right. If you take the person who suffers from post-holiday depression, are they prone to do that every year or does it go on a year-by-year basis?
It tends to be very cyclical. So it is actually preventable. So if you're a person who sees that, you know, ooh, I get this dip every winter where I feel down, to plan for that and either allow that, oh, you know what, this is just a time where I'm going to have some downtime. That's not the end of the world. Or I'm going to work to get myself out and about and moving this time of year instead of just sitting tight. Then, you know, you can kind of plan for it and make yourself a little more resilient to falling into that trap again this year.
You know what worked for me for years? Now, this wasn't a depression, but every year in September and October, in my head, I'd say to myself, well, now we've got 9 months of cold weather. It's not going to be nice. You're not going to be able to play outside.
Yeah.
You can go outside every once in a while, but it's not going to be nice again until June. So what I would do is I'd say to myself every month, find a couple of things to look forward to. What's coming up in 2 weeks? What's coming up in 3 weeks and 4 weeks? It could be big things. It could be little things. Work like a charm.
Brilliant. That is so smart, Bill. And you're pointing out something that a lot of us do. We will take an enormous chunk of our time and write it off. Right?
Yeah.
You know, so September to May is effectively, you know, and I think a lot of us do exactly what you're saying. Those 8 or 9 months of the year, those are going to be pretty bad.
Right.
So I'm looking forward, you know, September 3rd, I'm looking forward to, you know, June of next year.
Yeah.
And we're just wishing our time away. That's depressing, you know, like by definition. So you're right, to build in some things that you enjoy. And I think it's important always to have something that you look forward to, even if you're not wealthy, to create something. We're going to go downtown into the city in a couple of weeks. We're going to head up to
Perfect.
Wisconsin. And and just drive through for a while. You know,
yeah.
Something that feels positive and upbeat, and it's something you can look forward to. I think that is a great kind of remedy to the post-holiday.
Maybe it's a movie that's coming out. Maybe it's a date that you have with friends that you're going out to dinner. It can be a little thing. It
little
can be a big
things.
Thing. But just in your head, no. There's good stuff down the road.
Because
you know?
If you feel like there is,
I like to call that the dangling carrot.
The
it's
dangling
like you're
carrot.
Dangling something
perfect.
Good in front of you.
Yeah.
Perfect, exactly.
And sometimes it can be a dangling carrot.
Literally
you can just,
a dangling
you can
carrot.
Hang a carrot somewhere and look at it and
not
go,
cauliflower, though.
Who doesn't look forward to that?
That would break my resolution. What about this angle, the financial end of it? During the holidays, a lot of us tend to overspend, and you
right.
don't really realize it if you're putting it on a card. You go, I put plastic in a machine. It didn't cost me anything. And then all of a sudden, the bills come. I bet that's a contributor, isn't it? Isn't it?
Definitely. But using your theory of kind of breaking things down, you know, I'm going to look at this month to month. If you look at that bill,
yeah.
you know, a lot of us look at the giant number and we panic instead of thinking, and if Terry Savage were here, she would probably slap me. But but if you think like, okay, if I break this down and I do this in reasonable increments over
yeah.
time, this will be less painful than it would be if I just stare at this giant number and this hole I put myself in. You
yes.
know? Yeah.
Yeah. I want to ask you a question completely off the topic,
yeah.
but there's this video blogger. He's a guy named Logan Paul. I had never heard of him until about a month or two ago.
He is a jerk.
He showed up on some late night show, and everybody knew him and loved him, but
yeah.
I had no idea who he was. So he put out a video the other day. Evidently, in Asia, there's a place called the Suicide Forest.
Yeah.
It is, on all the planet, it's the place where most people tend to go to end their lives, very, very sadly.
Right.
So the nature of his video blog show is he goes places and has some quote-unquote fun with whatever's going on.
Right.
And he and his friends were walking through this forest, and they found a kid who had killed himself, a guy who had taken their own life. What are your thoughts on this? He has since apologized because he did a video where they were kind of taking this whole thing very, very lightly. What
yeah.
are your thoughts on all this?
Yeah, I actually saw parts of this video, and I get your point, Wendy. My initial inclination was, what a jerk. Especially, I'll share with you guys that in the past few weeks, I've been dealing with a number of teen suicides. So I always think about, like, families of people who are going through this, you know, and somebody who's treating it in any kind of cavalier way. It's really...
And the teenagers watch his YouTube videos.
Exactly.
That's what bothers me.
Exactly. So there's also that, like, that power of suggestion, right? That, you know, like, this is a way to gain some degree of fame. And kids who are suicidal are starting to use social media and YouTube to kind of... To lay out their message of despair,
right?
And this is their way of kind of preserving some degree of fame. And Logan Paul didn't forward that mission at all by putting out that video. I was really glad that he apologized for it.
Although, did you see the apology? Because it seems to me like the kind of thing he realized that his fan base was quickly shrinking
yeah.
as a result of this, so he was kind of trying to keep his head above water more than anything.
It's definitely damage control,
yeah.
No doubt. But I think it's a pointless thing to do, and it's not something that we should ever take lightly. You know, like because this happens in our culture more frequently than I think we know, because
yeah.
Because we tend not to talk about it. Obits tend not to say what's happened. So I think to treat it lightly is a massive mistake.
What you just said is very interesting to me. Obituaries now are purposely leaving out, and a lot of times in news stories also they're leaving out
yeah.
that suicide was behind the death. Is that a good thing or is that not a good thing?
You know, I tend to think it's not in the big picture. The reason that they do that psychologically is that they're avoiding the idea of copycats,
yeah.
right? They don't want kids kind of doing the same method in the same spot. And this has happened in the past.
Yeah.
But by omitting the cause, what happened, we're creating this taboo around it, you know,
yeah.
and so we're kind of cloistering and not talking about an issue that is so vitally important to talk about a lot,
yeah.
you know, and I think the more we talk about it, the more we give kids permission to talk about being depressed, feeling suicidal, feeling hopeless, lift that taboo, and kids feel more open, they feel permission to talk about it, and I got to tell you, I really believe that kids are going to be far less likely to commit that act. I don't think they're so suggestible as a lot of the media would have us believe.
But the numbers have been beyond alarming in the last couple of years.
The numbers are definitely increasing. I think that has a lot to do with kind of perceived cultural pressure on kids that age.
Wendy, go ahead. I'm sorry.
And speaking of media, and I know just from taking journalism classes, and Kim Gordon can comment on this too, years ago when a story came up in the news cycle that it was a suicide, it was not reported at all. It's just so-and-so lost their life and nothing was mentioned.
Right.
And I am seeing a lot of obituaries now that are mentioning suicide and drug addiction more and more to try and help other families, because there have been just so many kids that have died at the hands of heroin, and their parents are trying to say, look, this can happen to you as well. And I've seen that a lot in obituaries lately.
I've seen that as well, Wendy, and a lot of families coming forth on social media and things, creating foundations for the kids who have taken their lives, who have been depressed. And I think that is all really, really positive, you know, and making the best of a really, really difficult situation. And you got to think that the opioid crisis, what you're talking about, is part of the answer there, right? Making that more visible and being clear how many people are affected. And it's not just who you're going to think.
You know, Wendy, from a news standpoint, just real quick, we don't report suicides unless it's something that is very exceptional or impacts other people in other ways. Otherwise, we try to stay clear of it, too.
Yeah.
But I think you're right. I mean, now people hear about more of suicides and things like that in a social media setting as a way to help others. But
it makes sense.
Celebrities, Robin Williams, Chris Cornell.
Right.
You know, that has been reported.
Right. Right. And I suppose not reporting it, but letting the family take care of it takes away that, you know, gives them a little power in the situation.
Yeah, maybe.
You know, controlling the flow of information, because some people don't want that out there. And some families want to make that the kind of like legacy of the person.
Absolutely. If you want to hear more,
it's a new year.
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
If you want to hear more from Dr. John Duffy, you can. His podcast is available at WGN Plus. Again, the book is called The Available Parent, or listen to him here every other Wednesday. Thank you, John. Have
Thank
a great
guys.
New year. This is so soothing.
Isn't it?
This is so soothing. It's Bill Evans.
It makes me feel smarter.
Just hearing the song.
Yeah.
That's all it takes. This is the horn part that I love so much. This is Al Hertz. Boy, is he good. It's Bill Leff. It's Wendy Snyder. let's talk game shows for just a little bit. I'm sure you've noticed there's been an incredible resurgence in game shows. Shows like Match Game are back on with Alec Baldwin hosting.
Are you liking
Joker's
that?
Wild. You know, I do and I don't. Here's what I noticed. In the first Match Game, in the Gene Rayburn days of Match Game, there was definitely some sexual innuendo. But now, oh my God, I can't believe, I don't know if you saw last week's episode, but every single question, the answer was the same, and that was the male sexual organ.
It's pretty racy.
Oh man, is it racy.
I like it, though. I think it's fun.
Is it? It's funny racy or just racy?
It depends.
It's funny, but... Like I said, in the early days, you know, they'd go to Charles Nelson Reilly or Brett Summers or Richard Dawson, and they would hint at something that was kind of sexual, but it seemed, I'm not going to say it's too taboo, I can't even say it in front of Gene Rayburn. And now this time, every single question, the answer is penis. Every single one. Over and over and over and over. There was a...
That doesn't happen on Jeopardy.
No. No, it does not happen on Jeopardy.
Alex
Wendy.
Would faint.
Oh, he wouldn't have it. He wouldn't have it. All right, speaking of Jeopardy, this is the reason I've called you all in assembly here. On the very first episode of Jeopardy that was shown this week, the first episode of 2018, there's a guy that would have won a whole bunch of money, Nick Spricker, but there was a problem in his answer. Have you already heard this audio, Wendy?
I have, but some people haven't.
This is very, very upsetting. Here's the story, and then we'll play the audio, and you decide whether or not this guy had the correct answer on Jeopardy or not. On the first episode of 2018, contestants were given this double Jeopardy clue to win $1,600. The clue reads, it's a song by Coolio from Dangerous Minds, and it goes back in time to become a 1667 John Milton classic. The category was music and literature before and afters. So you have to combine two answers to get one big answer. It's a popular theme, it says, on the quiz show, where contestants must combine well-known entities to create a new phrase. The contestant, Nick Spricker, buzzed in and was very confident when he answered, "What is Gangster's Paradise Lost?" But the answer was incorrect. Now listen to this moment from Jeopardy. His answer, again, was Gangster's Paradise Lost, but the correct answer was Gangsta's Paradise Lost, A apostrophe S, not ER apostrophe S. Listen to this moment from Jeopardy.
A song by Coolio from Dangerous Minds goes back in time to become a 1667 John Milton classic. Nick.
What is Gangster's Paradise Lost?
Yes. Our judges have reevaluated one of your responses a few moments ago, Nick. You said gangsters instead of gangstas on that song by Coolio. So we take 3,200 away from you.
Yikes.
So you are now in second place.
3,200. All right, so they originally gave it to him, and then they reevaluated.
Which they shouldn't have.
See, that's the thing. If you give it to him initially, are you allowed to go back and take it away? If you were the judge on Jeopardy yesterday, Wendy, and I know you've done this in the past, where you are, it is up to your discretion as to whether or not the answers are correct or not. If a guy says Gangster's Paradise instead of Gangsta's Paradise, does he get the point or not get the point?
I would have made that face that it's kind of like, I'm sorry, I can't give it to you. That's what I would have said.
Oh, really?
But you can't give it to them and then come back and go, well, our judges have just said something in my ear, and no, we have to take it back.
Interesting.
I don't know
if they do that in football and baseball on a replay. I mean, I guess if you go back, even in, you know, if you watch $100,000 Pyramid, they'll go back and see, you know, if you got it before the ding.
Right. I've seen them do that.
It does happen.
Yeah.
Well, they'll reevaluate, but I think gangsta versus gangster is a pretty.
All right, two different things, guys.
But here's the thing. The word gangsta comes from the word gangster.
Right.
So in that instance, don't you say to yourself, well, that's close enough.
Yeah.
But you need the name of the Coolio song, and it's not Gangster's Paradise.
No, that's true. It is Gangsta's Paradise.
It's Gangsta's.
Yeah. Do you remember a couple years ago, a guy had an answer on Jeopardy where the answer was Wimbledon, but he said Wimbledon, which is what, seriously, most people say. Even though it's spelled D-O-N, more people say Wimbledon than Wimbledon. So in that instance, and that was for a victory on Jeopardy, nope, you don't get it. It's Wimbledon, not Wimbledon.
You and guys, it's Jeopardy. You have to do it
to the letter. To the letter. But doesn't this also show that Alex Trebek, even though he pretends to know all the correct answers, he doesn't, because he, Alex Trebek, should have said right there at the time, no, 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 Gangsta's Paradise, not Gangster's Paradise.
I would love to hear him do that. No, 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 no,
no, no, no, no, no, no, no. The all-knowing Alex Trebek, if he really knows as much as he pretends to know, he should have been on this from second one and just said, oh, well, no, it's Gangsta. Come on.
I don't know. I wouldn't have given it to him.
Very upsetting.
Originally.
So, yeah. So now the guy's not even, I'm trying to find if anywhere in the story the guy is complaining, because I'd have Rich Lankoff on him. I'd sue him.
Was Al Capone a gangster or a gangster?
Al Capone was a gangster, because I think even back then, if you called a gangster a gangster, they would say, I'm sorry, you're saying gangster completely wrong. It's gangster, not gangster.
And they'd shoot you.
Yeah. A lot of the gangland hits back in the 1920s were for that, because people were mispronouncing the job. All right, and now I have some even more distressing news, if that wasn't distressing enough. Remember yesterday we read you the Moody's death list? These are the list of businesses that could potentially go under in 2018. These are businesses that were not doing well, and they believe over at Moody's that a lot of these businesses will probably not see 2019. It was JCPenney's, it was Sears, it was Payless, it was Toys R Us. I didn't even get to that one on air yesterday.
Oh, boy.
Toys R Us, they said, might go under. Well, now I have two more to add to it. This is not from Moody's, but these are from separate stories. I don't know if you saw this, but it looks like Playboy magazine may not be in magazine form anymore.
Wait,
is that shocking?
They had trouble before.
They did have trouble, and they fixed, or they tried to fix it by taking away the naked ladies. They said,
yeah,
well, we won't put any more naked ladies in Playboy.
Crazy gangsters.
And then in Cat Enthusiast, they said, no more pictures of cats. We're not going to show you any more cats. Get
nice
your cats elsewhere.
There,
oh, I see what you did. That's dangerous. You're Lenny Bruce. All right. So I should have gone with crossword puzzle enthusiast, shouldn't I? No more crossword puzzles and crossword puzzle enthusiasts. Yeah. So Playboy says they want to focus more on World of Playboy. What is that? Do we know what World of Playboy is?
Like World of Wheels?
It's like World of Wheels. It can't be their nightclubs because those are all gone. What? I don't even know what World of Playboy is, but Playboy says they're thinking about putting an end to the magazine and focusing more on World of Playboy. I guess that's websites and stuff, right? But that's the thing. If you're in the market to see a lady without her clothes on, why would you go and pick up a Playboy magazine when on the internet there's probably a dozen pictures, maybe more, of women without their clothes on?
I'm looking at them now.
Right now, during the show. All right, so that's one thing that may go away. And the other one, put your seatbelts on, everybody. This is the most dangerous one of all. Chocolate may not be in existence after 2050. Chocolate.
Stop. Come on.
That's what they say, Kim. I don't want to. Don't shoot me. I'm just the messenger. It says here, this is according to MSN, you may love chocolate, but you should probably start preparing yourself to say goodbye to it. Scientists at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration have predicted that cocoa plants are likely to go extinct as early as 2050 due to climate changes. No more chocolate. But there's one glimmer.
Well, the rainforests were going away. Do they need that kind of thing to grow cacao?
Cacao. Isn't that Kaylee, whatever her name is from?
Kaylee Cuoco.
Yeah, will she still be in existence? I hope so.
Nope.
She's also going away.
She's
stupid
done.
Climate change. It says there's one glimmer of hope on the horizon, though. Mars, the candy company which makes such chocolate treats as Snickers and Twix bars, has teamed up with the University of California on a new method that may help save cacao crops.
I'm feeling hydroponic chocolate.
I think you're right.
Coming soon.
Right.
I'm feeling chemical chocolate, which is what we're probably already eating.
Oh,
yeah.
Man. Most of the world's...
still good.
It's still good. It's not as good, but it's still good. Most of the world's chocolate comes from West Africa. The plants thrive in the region's rainforests, but over the next 40 years, the Earth's rising temperatures will push cacao farms. Am I saying that even close to right? Farms? How do you say it? To areas either unsuitable for cultivation or already reserved as wildlife preserves. Ladies and gentlemen, we have to have chocolate. What do we have if we don't have chocolate?
Vanilla. A lot of unhappy people.
A lot of unhappy people. The tours over at the Wonka factory will stop immediately. We can't have that.
Unemployed Oompa Loompas is a horrible thing.
Right. I know Trump has said that he wants to save certain coal miners, and that's a good thing. But do you want out-of-work Oompa Loompas? I don't think you do. I don't think so. All right, we'll take a quick break, and then there's more show. If you'd like to jump in, we would love to hear from you. We are at 312-981-7200. You can call us there or text us there. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. Wendy, do you keep bumping your head on the microphone?
I'm sorry. I moved the microphone out of the way of my mouth so I can drink my coffee.
Because
I don't want you to hear me gulping.
No.
But then I guess you hear the
microphone. It sounds like you keep bumping your head every couple seconds. Which I know is a side effect of having a knee surgery. I know that for a fact.
Can I bring back that crazy blogger that you talked about with Dr. John Duffy?
Absolutely.
What's his name again?
His name's Logan Paul. And like I said, I had never heard of this guy. I had no idea who this guy was. There's now, you can be famous just on YouTube. The old ways of being famous, like doing something important, those days are gone. All you have to do now is post videos of yourself doing anything on YouTube, and you can become a celebrity. And this guy kind of did. He showed up on one of the late night talk shows, and everybody treated him like he was royalty. And I'm like, I've never even heard of this guy, Logan Paul. But he got in some trouble this week.
Before this came forward with him in the suicide garden or whatever,
suicide forest.
Dylan, my 15-year-old son, was showing me this guy who happened to be Logan Paul, and he claimed that he was colorblind. And Dylan showed me this video, and Logan was like, I can't see. He gave himself a colorblind test on the YouTube video, and he's like, I can't see these numbers. You know how they would put a circle, and then you'd see like a number two middle of the circle?
Yeah.
Well, he kept saying how he can't, decipher colors, so he got these alleged colorblind glasses from a viewer, and it was going to change his life. So he goes on video, and he puts these glasses on, and Bill, it was the biggest joke in the world. He was trying to make it look like it was for reals. He was, he was like in tears, like, oh my God, I can finally see color. It was ridiculous. And then these other YouTubers were showing us this video of him doing it, and then they went back 2 months where this Logan Paul guy was totally talking about colors in his room and how he could flash different colors. So this guy is just a scammer, a liar, and it just bothers me that these young teenage boys are watching this.
So that's his audience, right, is essentially teenage boys. Yeah.
And then I asked Dylan, you know, is he related to Aaron Paul, you know, from Breaking Bad? And I guess Aaron Paul blasted Logan Paul and told him to go rot in hell and said, you know, I am not related to this guy. He's a loser. So thankfully he's saying, you know, he's a jerk. Go rot in hell was the quote from Aaron Paul.
The response has been extremely negative, and you would hope so. I mean, suicide is a horrible, horrible thing, and this guy and his friends were just out there in this forest in Asia really making light of the whole thing. If you watch I've seen the video. The video is very disturbing, and I got to be honest, his apology is equally as disturbing because, like with many of these celebrity apologies, it's very empty. It's him realizing, uh-oh, my bread and butter is being on YouTube and doing a certain thing, and that could be taken away from me very, very quickly. So it's a very half-hearted apology.
Which most of these are, it seems. And then, again, I feel sorry for Aaron Paul because the first thing I asked my son is, any relation? And so Aaron Paul wrote this, Dear Logan Paul, how dare you? You disgust me. I can't believe that so many young people look up to you. It's so sad. Hopefully this latest video woke them up. You are pure trash, plain and simple. Suicide is not a joke. Go rot in hell.
How about that? Happy holidays. Now, he's got a brother who is also a video blogger on YouTube, and I guess an actor.
Yeah.
I'd never heard of his brother either. He looks, every time I see him, I think this is a cross between like a teenage Woody Harrelson and Jay Moore. Doesn't he look like somewhere in the middle of those two?
Oh, my God. Absolutely, 100%.
Yeah. Jay Moore, for people who don't know, from Jerry Maguire, an actor and a comedian. But he's got that same kind of a look to him. But, I watched the apology, and it just seemed as empty could be, you know? We were also talking a little while ago about the incident on Jeopardy where a guy said gangsta paradise. He said gangster paradise. It should have been gangsta paradise. This text has come to us from the 847 area code. Bill and Wendy, on Wheel of Fortune a few years ago, the answer was New York Jets. The letters were all filled in. The person, I guess the category was, who are these people? I've seen that before. They show it, the category is a group of people, and then, you know, letter by letter, it's divulged. The contestant said, the New York Jets. He was wrong because he said the. The answer was New York Jets, and so the next person got it. Now, with that one,
that's wrong.
Just saying the is
wrong? There were no letters that said T-H-E. You have to read it precisely as it is revealed.
But don't you think it's just grammatically correct to put the in there? You're referring to a group, and they are the New York Jets. I mean, the New York Jets are known as the New York Jets. Don't you think in that instance?
Yeah, but you didn't turn around a T, an H, and an E, so that's not part of the puzzle.
But the part isn't the puzzle. It's him just setting up the answer to the puzzle. You know what I mean? I would have given it to him. Did Trebek take that one away from him, too? Because Trebek has no jurisdiction on Wheel of Fortune. Trebek only all of his power is only on Jeopardy. He can't go to other shows, can he? What kind of world are we living in where Alex Trebek can just go from show to show and tell people that their answers are invalid? And no chocolate all in the same week? I don't want that.
Isn't he the longest person who has hosted a game show at this
I don't know
point?
Him that well, Wendy. It's possible. I have no idea. I don't know. I know that in the early days of Jeopardy, there was a man named Art Fleming who was incredibly pleasant.
Right.
Do you remember Art Fleming in the mornings?
And when he was cranky?
He wasn't cranky, but his attitude was different from Trebek's. Trebek, if you answer wrong on Jeopardy, Trebek looks at you like, I thought you were better than this. Doesn't he? He's just got that look like,
yeah.
I know it's Magna Carta. Everyone knows it's Magna Carta. Why didn't you say Magna Carta? What's wrong with you? Say Magna Carta. No, now it's too late. That's what you get from Trebek. Art Fleming was much more forgiving if you were incorrect. That's the way game shows used to be.
Him.
Slightly more forgiving. Now, if you're wrong, like I watched the show last night. I didn't see the whole show. I saw 5 minutes of the show. It's Ellen DeGeneres, and you have to answer questions. And if you answer incorrectly, this will sound like I dreamt this, but this is real. They have harnesses on them.
I can back you up.
You saw this too? I didn't dream this, right?
I saw the preview of this.
All right. So it's three people, and their whole goal is to solve a puzzle. They're given giant puzzle pieces, and they have to put them in a board. There's like 10 pieces, right? So then the one who wins. They get to stay on the show. And the ones who lose, they're catapulted into the rafters of the studio. They're like shot up 40 feet in the air.
Why don't we be on this one? This is perfect for you.
I can't. Someone's going to get killed.
Well, I saw a different one where they spun people around so that they were so dizzy, and then they had to go find a button to hit to give the right
answer.
This
was on the same show on last night's?
No, this was not last night's. This was another one because she's been on before. And then another one was if you got the answer wrong, they dropped you like down the...
There's a trap door. I saw that last night too. There was a trap door and they shot him into the boiler room.
Yeah.
It's Ellen's Game of Games.
That's what it is. Yeah.
And is it funny?
Well, it's funny because people are so freaking out that they're going to get dropped, you know, down the tube or whatever it is.
Right.
So they're so nervous about that they can't even think about what the answer to the question is.
But I can't figure out, like when I'm watching these, if we're evolving or devolving, because I can't figure out, like in the old days, you just had to show up and be smart and you were rewarded. They gave you big money. They go, oh, you're smarter than those guys, so here's money. But now if you're wrong, you're either set on fire or they throw you in carrots.
I'd say we're devolving. What about you?
I think we are. I hate to say it.
Especially
Ellen
if you
DeGeneres
can't even get gangsta right?
I know.
Ellen DeGeneres hosts the exciting new game show that's One Big Party.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Isn't it a party?
Yeah, I guess it is. I didn't realize it at the time.
A nervous party? Your palms are
would
sweating
you go to a party?
Every moment.
Wendy, let's say Kim was having a holiday party and she said, half the guests will be treated to delicacies. They'll be able to eat like kings and queens, but the other half will be just catapulted into the rafters of my home. Would you attend that party?
No.
No. Who would go to that?
Do we get to pick the other people?
You do get to pick the other people, Steve. Good point. All right, we'll take a quick break, and then we'll find out what Steve has on the Wintrust Business Lunch. That's coming up next. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.